News. From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show, connecting you with your neighborhood and the world. It's Tech Tuesday. Tim O'Reilly wears lots of hats in the world of technology. He's part journalist and publisher, part open source evangelist, part digital philosopher. As the founder of O'Reilly Media, he spent the last three decades looking ahead of the curve for ideas and trends that will change the world. A search for cutting-edge ideas that these days leads him here to Washington. O'Reilly says we're at the dawn of Government 2.0, a historic opportunity to make government more transparent, more accountable, and more collaborative, and an opportunity to shock people out of old ways of thinking about change and what it means to be an informed and active citizen. Tim O'Reilly joins us in the studio. He is the founder and CEO of O'Reilly Media Incorporated. Great to have you aboard.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Social networking sites like Facebook and Twitter have transformed the way we get our news, how we communicate with each other, even how we make and keep friends. But most of us don't realize how much impact these sites and other newer apps could have on democracy itself. You're in town to stir the pot, so to speak. Tell us about Government 2.0.
Yeah, well, social media is certainly part of it, no question. But there's more to it than that. Let me tell you the story of how I got involved in this idea. First of all, I've been interested for a long time in the idea of open government. And the reason I've been interested is for the same reason I'm interested in any other new technology, just that I see interesting innovators, often people who you'd consider hackers, playing in that area. You know, so I open my talks often with a story about Wi-Fi. I'll get to Gov 2.0.
Oh, go ahead.
So when Wi-Fi came out, all the corporations that were pushing it, so this is a local area networking technology for the corporate market, we knew immediately it was going to be everywhere because all the hackers we knew were up on rooftops with homebrew antennas, right? And in a similar way, the open government movement is really started at the very beginning of the web, all the way back in 1993 when there were only a few thousand websites. There was a hacker named Carl Malamud, who's still an open government activist, who helped put the SEC online from the outside. They were like, why would anybody want access to all these SEC filings? You know, they're available to lawyers and big financiers. Why would the public need this stuff? Carl got a $50,000 grant from the National Science Foundation, some donated computers, some volunteer hackers. They put the SEC EDGAR database online in about 6 weeks, and they operated it for a year and a half and then donated it to the federal government. That's how the SEC got online.
That's the genius of it. After they operated it themselves and donated it to the federal government, by then the SEC couldn't abandon it because people really wanted it.
That's right. And so anyway, so I've been following this and kind of looking at organizations like the Sunlight Foundation or GovTrack. There's a whole lot of sort of outside-in initiatives. But the pattern that you see typically in technology, and I've seen this in my career from the web, where we published about it in a book called The Whole Internet User's Guide and Catalog, when there were only 200 websites, to open source software. We were publishing about it for a decade before it hit the mainstream. And then we launched our conferences and really started marketing it, or Web 2.0 when everybody thought the web was over. In each of these cases, you could see that there was this acceleration and that the hackers were starting to be replaced by entrepreneurs. So guess what happened in 2007, 2008? This entrepreneur came along and he put all the work, the best work that had been done by these hackers together and did the most amazing startup of the year. It was called mybarackobama.com. And he used all the principles of Web 2.0, community organizing. You know, he built a self-service platform, a lot like Craigslist, really, in which people could set up their own promotions, their own fundraisers. It was beautiful. And of course, he succeeded in winning the presidency. And now he's, so this thing is going mainstream. And the first thing he does is he puts in people like Anish Chopra and Vivek Kundra.
Yeah, stole Vivek Kundra from us here in the District of Columbia.
That's right. And they're starting to say, well, what does it mean to be Gov2.0? And part of it is that outreach to citizens and allowing, you know, social networking and allowing comment and doing things with wikis. But the biggest thing that it's about, and this is really the theme of this event that we're putting together, the Gov2 Summit and the related Gov2 Expo, by the way, it's gov2summit.com and gov2expo.com for details in the fall, is this idea of government as a platform. Because one of the lessons that we can take from the success of technology platforms is that they enable innovation by others. You know, there aren't 50,000 applications on the iPhone because Apple wrote them all. And we have to start rethinking the operations of government, particularly in the IT sector, but everywhere, away from the idea that government delivers complete services and more towards government does things that we, the people, build on. You know, a great example of this is GPS. You know, look at all the innovation in the market that comes because the military did the hard part and put up some satellites, but then they made that service available. That's platform thinking. And of course, data.gov and what Vivek is doing is trying to say, okay, we're going to really for the first time build an SDK, a software development kit for the government as platform.
It's Tech Tuesday. Our guest is Tim O'Reilly, founder and CEO of O'Reilly Media Incorporated. We take your calls at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. What is your interpretation of government 2.0? What opportunities and obstacles do you see? You can also send us a tweet at Kojo Show, or as we said, if the phone lines are busy, you can shoot us an email to kojo@wamu.org. Web 2.0 describes the internet's change from a service to a platform. You're saying we can do the same thing with government.
That's absolutely true. Now, one of the
we see our government, the kind of, as you described it, as a vending machine.
Yeah.
We tend to think of activism and democracy as, or activism and advocacy as kicking or tinkering with that machine. We never think of building our own machine or with affecting the way the machine works on the inside.
I totally agree. I think that's a really fantastic insight. There's a guy who's a fellow over at the National Academy of Public Administration named Kettle who brought in that image of vending machine government. You know, we pay our taxes and out comes a school, a road, you know, a hospital. And, you know, and we think that collective action means shaking the vending machine. You know, use that image, you know, a protest or, and yes, I mean, there's certainly wonderful stories of how protest has affected government. But the real issue that we have to rediscover is government as a vehicle for collective action. You know, when you look back at the founders, for example, Ben Franklin was somebody who he created the matching grant, which was an idea that people raise, this, you know, individuals raise this much money, the government will match it. Mm-hmm. He ran a volunteer fire brigade. You know, this was really all about, and then government was just one more way that we, the people, get together to do things. And, you know, it's now become this institution with a life of its own, and we've forgotten that it's a lever, it's a tool. And, you know, there's this great story I tell in my talks, which just it came from a CNN story I read back in April. A real Gov2.0 story. There was a not what people normally think of. You know, when they think Gov2.0, they think social media used by the White House or Congress is on Twitter.
Right.
I look at this and I go, okay, there's a road into a state park gets washed out. The government says we don't have enough money to fix it.
Right.
The local people say, oh my God, that'll really hurt our economy. They get together, local businesses, volunteers. They repair the road themselves. The park reopens. You know, and now you think about what if government said, instead of our job being to say, well, we have $8 million, we're going to hire a bunch of people, pay way too much money to fix this thing, our job is to organize and coordinate the action of our citizens.
So when we're talking government 2.0, we're talking government to citizen, we're talking citizen to government, we're talking citizen to citizen, and we're talking government to government.
That's right. That's a great insight. That's from John Geraci, who runs a site called DIYcity.org, which is, you know, this wonderful idea of like, well, how do we start building the tools, because it isn't just how we talk to our government. It's how governments talk to each other. How do different divisions? And one of the big problems we have in our current government is immense duplication of effort, incompatible systems, people doing the same thing over and over again. So adopting open source software is a really good step. Adopting cloud computing. I mean, the government's taking a look at a cloud computing platform, and it's really great because they're really one of their key points in their RFI is, you know, what are your plans for interoperability? How are we going to get our data out? How are multiple vendors going to work together? They're starting to really think about how do we build a system where we cooperate instead of everybody builds their own silo.
I want to get to the telephones. 800-433-8850 is the number to call. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. But first, you're here in Washington. You mentioned it earlier to try to build bridges between the tech worlds of Silicon Valley and the halls of power in Congress. Tell us about the two conferences that you're convening at the end of the summer.
Well, this is really modeled on the Web 2.0 Summit and the Web 2.0 Expo that we hold. Now, those events, people don't realize, they think Web 2.0 meant there was a new version of the web. And actually, what it was in the middle of the dot-com bust. Everybody said the web is over. And we said, no, it's coming back more than ever. And we told a story about what the successful companies were doing and what people coming up should do. So we started out with a thought leadership event, the summit, where we invited in CEOs to kind of ratify that story. You know, to say, yeah, you know, there is a new game in town. Here are the new rules of business. Yes, we buy this story. And then we used that to highlight the innovators who were up and coming so that people could see that there really was something happening here. And then later we introduced an expo because there was this commercial ecology happening. And so what we're really trying to do is the same thing here. We're trying to tell a big story about what Gov 2.0 means. We're getting it ratified by senior people like Anish Chopra and Vivek Kundra, and we have a bunch of people from the DOD. We're looking at some speakers we haven't completely confirmed yet, so we can't announce. We hope to have you there as a moderator.
I hope to be there.
We also have all these stories of innovation, both from within government and from outside. And, you know, our hope is to give support to the innovators in government, because there's three classes of people. There's people who have heard the message from President Obama, and they know what to do because they've been trying to do it all along. There's people who hear the message and they say, help us, we don't know what to do. You know, how do we do it?
The steep learning curve.
And then, so that's really the second event, which we really, this first time, the Gov 2.0 showcase is really, it's a precursor to the expo, because we don't think the commercial ecology is really there yet. So we're really doing a kind of like a single preview day. And then next spring, we're going to have the full expo. But really, the two events will happen each year. One, as I said, being a sort of a thought leadership event where we're really trying to get the senior leaders on board, kind of all singing from the same hymn book, so working with their staff, and then the expo, and there'll be a technical conference with that, which really will be really the implementer's tool. That's where somebody will say, okay, yeah, I want to put up a community site with Drupal. How do I do it?
You can find links to the plans for those events at our website, kojoshow.org. Now don your headphones, because we're about to talk with Tony in New York City. Tony, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello, Kojo. It's great to be a guest. Great to be calling in. I listen to your show over the web here in New York City, where I'm working on a project for NYC.gov called Business Express. What Business Express takes a lot of the services where a person would have to walk in, possibly stand in line at a city agency such as Department of Buildings, and put some of these applications and licenses online. And it streamlines the whole process, and it also gives the city a way of not only awarding licenses but collecting licensing fees, and also if informs the users up there if there's any change to license statuses. So by giving the user the ability to come into to literally log onto their computer, manage a business relationship with the city, in turn it gives the city the ability to collect licensing fees, and also if there's any fines or any other information that they need to distribute, it gives them a direct line to the business owner. And what this allows, first I have to say that we have a very forward-thinking mayor, and Mayor Bloomberg, who's also a technocrat. So what he understands is that by being able to disseminate the information to those who will need to use it, we are actually streamlining the process of government.
Well, hey, tell Mayor Bloomberg if he wants to come be part of our show. We'd love to have him.
He's more than invited. But is there the opportunity for interactivity for the individuals who are applying for the licenses to interact with the government in such a way that the government is informed about what it needs to do better?
Yes, actually it is. What we're doing is we're also developing the ability for users to give feedback to the city. So if a circumstance arises where a user understands a way to streamline the system or, in fact, update their business status, they're actually allowed to interact with New York City Business Express. The first step on Business Express is that you literally will build your business. You will say where you're located, your address information, your business address information, and other contact information. And from there, you're able to generate profiles, which basically, if you say, I would like to open up a pizzeria, but I would like to find what part of the city is most advantageous for this pizzeria, and the method of, say, for example, receiving federal initiatives, state initiatives, local initiatives, the money is out there, and we would like to connect. Business Express allows the users to develop a business online first.
Let me ask you one question here. I mean, this does sound like a great service and a great step up. But one of the things I'm concerned about in the design, you know, I try to take lessons from the technology community. And one very, very important lesson is that the most powerful platforms allow for unexpected results. You know, when Tim Berners-Lee created the World Wide Web, or Vint Cerf and Bob Kahn created TCP/IP, they did not imagine in any way all the things that have been built on top of their tool, right? Yet when we design systems for government, we try to think, we're going to figure out everything that people want to do. And, you know, so one of the questions I have for you is, you know, do you support, again, if I don't know your relation to the New York City government, but if I were the government, I would say, okay, Business Express shouldn't just be an application. It should be a platform. And what a platform would allow is that if somebody had a better way to deliver that service, they could use those services as well, as opposed to this is the one and only New York City way of doing it. You know, a great example of this, you know, if you look at, for example, online mapping, we all, you know, kind of take for granted that, you know, we can, you know, get maps and directions. And so many of the useful mapping mashups, and all of those are built, so many of them are built on Google Maps rather than, say, Microsoft Maps or Yahoo Maps or MapQuest or back on other people's platforms. Because Google, when they were first hacked back in 2005 by the guy who built housingmaps.com, they said, whoa, good idea. We never thought of that. And they opened up their APIs, they hired him, and they basically ran with it. And now, like almost all mapping mashups are built on Google rather than the competitors, because they understood that the users often innovate before the people who kind of are building the system. So you've got to build innovation into this.
Tony, is that one of the things that your system allows for?
Well, yes, it does have flexibility where we can not only take the feedback from the users, but we could also take the feedback from the individual agencies that we're serving. We are acting sort of along the line of a portal. Thinking forward, hopefully it will begin to resemble something like that.
I got to take a short break, Tony, but thank you very much for your call, and good luck to you. It's Tech Tuesday. We're talking with Tim O'Reilly, founder and CEO of O'Reilly Media Incorporated. Taking your calls at 800-433-8850. You can send email to koju@wamu.org. We're discussing Government 2.0 and inviting your calls and comments. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tomorrow at noon on the Tomorrow at noon on the Kojo Nandi Show, Metro General Manager John Cato takes your calls, emails, and tweets. More information at conversation.wamu.org. The Kojo Nandi Show, tomorrow at noon on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from CDWG. Whether for the work group or enterprise, they help federal agencies manage projects with technology solutions and specialists. CDWG, the right technology right away.
President Obama recently announced a new way to jumpstart the economy and train workers for emerging industries, send $12 billion to community colleges.
Wolf Blonde programs that connect students looking for jobs with businesses that are looking to hire.
How often overlooked community colleges are now at the center of the country's plans for economic recovery. That's next time on Tell Me More.
That's on Tell Me More at 2 here on WAMU 88.5.
Listening to WAMU 88.5 is easy. Turn on the radio and enjoy in-depth news and information programs that you can't find anywhere else. Supporting WAMU 88.5? It's just as easy. Become a member or renew your support at 800-248-8850 or online at wamu.org/support. Then turn on the radio and enjoy. You make a difference in what you hear, and thank you for your support.
We're talking on this Tech Tuesday with Tim O'Reilly, founder and CEO of O'Reilly Media Incorporated, and taking your calls at 800-433-8850. You can send email to Kojo at WAMU.org, or you can send us a tweet at Kojo Show. We got this email from Charlie, who says, Tim, what's your take on HTML5 as a web designer developer? I'd love to hear your thoughts on whether or not it's time to start adopting it.
I think absolutely. If you look at the next generation of web applications, now, actually, let me back up a little bit. Web applications, you've got to remember, have a front end and a back end. And the back end is usually some giant database that actually grows through user contribution. But the front end right now is not as rich as it could be. And what HTML5 is going to allow people to do is to build much, much richer front ends, the kind of things that you can do now with Flash. And the fact is, it's supported by modern browsers. And the fact is, if Microsoft doesn't get with the program, well, they'll really will lose even more market share to the browsers that do support HTML5. I think even though the standard is not finalized, we're starting to see the killer apps already. I mean, if you've looked at Google Wave, for example, it's pretty damn impressive what you can do in the way of rethinking email, and I'm sure rethinking other applications once you have access to a richer suite of front-end tools.
Here in D.C., we have the Apps for Democracy contest, which encourages third parties to design programs using government data. Today, we have a very powerful example of a third-party site doing Government 2.0. Tell us a little bit about EveryBlock.
Yeah, EveryBlock is actually a fantastic service that actually was also one of those very early Google Maps mashups from 2005. A guy named Adrian Hallavati, who's also, by the way, for the real techies in the audience, he's also one of the co-creators of a Python framework called Django. And absolutely brilliant guy. And what he did was he created a site called ChicagoCrime.org, where he basically put Chicago crime data onto a map. He then got funding from the Knight Foundation, which is from newspaper business, and he developed this out into a company called EveryBlock, which puts government data on maps for local municipalities. By the way, I'm going to have Adrian on the program because he is one of the pioneers. But again, this is this great, story. It starts with a hacker who's doing a mashup just for fun. The other thing that's amazing...
We have EveryBlock for Washington, D.C., by the way, and we're going to have a link on it at kojoshow.org, but go ahead.
One amazing thing about Adrian also that I think is really, really important, we're really talking a lot about the way the news business is changing. And Adrian's other shtick, he's one of those guys who's just like fertile in so many different ways, was a series of talks and lectures he did on how programmers can be of assistance to journalists. And he used to give a talk about computer programming as journalism. Because if you think about so many local services, they're really programmable. The example he used to give, he was at a place called the Lawrence Journal World in Kansas, small town. And they said, well, we can't send a reporter out to every little league game and every little soccer game. But what we can do, and this is where the programmer comes in, if we have the schedule, we can create an empty web page for every game and let the parents upload their pictures, right? So there's this wonderful quote from Edwin Schlossberg, who's married to Carolyn Kennedy, a great thinker. I read this in Parade magazine 30 years ago, 35 years ago, and it stuck in my head. He said, the skill of writing is to create a context in which other people can think. And I adapt that to what Adrian was talking about. Say the skill of programming is to create a context in which other people can share.
You know, you majored in Greek and Latin studies as an undergraduate at Harvard, and some people would say that's not exactly the academic background we would typically associate with information technology, but listening to you talk, it becomes apparent. You've said that complex problems require simple answers in a way that paradox is an idea that's underpinned in the classics, and you seem to bring a lot of that to your approach to technology.
Yeah, I think generally liberal arts are just a reminder that unless you have a clear idea of what you want to do as a profession, liberal arts is really just prepping your mind, because you're going to actually learn a lot more after your career in school. I basically came out of Harvard. I wasn't going to become a classics professor. So first thing I did was write a book about science fiction writer Frank Herbert. I convinced myself that I was a writer. And then I had a friend that was a computer programmer who got asked to write a manual. And he said, would you help me? And because I had skills as a writer, I didn't know anything about computers. I actually got my first job as a technical writer the same day that I saw my first computer.
Whoa.
And what we did, but what I was good at as a result of the classics background was, close reading of a manuscript. If it's a dead language, you don't really get facile with it in the same way you do a spoken language. So I was used to parsing this thing, and you'd read it, and all of a sudden a light would go off, and you go, oh, I get how all these words fit together. And so when I first started in tech, a lot of what I did was very similar. I'd read these specs, and it was like Greek to me, right? But if I read them long enough, and I read them carefully enough, and I read enough around them, all of a sudden the pattern emerged, and I would see, oh, this fits with that. And I think that was actually very shaping for me, because so much of my career has been about pattern recognition. When I said, back in 1997, when I first started talking about open source software, I brought together this group of people because I said, oh, all these guys are doing the same thing, but they don't know each other. They're not telling the same story. And it was sort of recognizing what they had in common. We're doing this right now with this amazing, one of my closest coworkers, a guy named Dale Doherty, and he launched a magazine called Make Magazine, which is an amazing DIY movement, DIY magazine. Subtitle is Technology on Your Own Time. But here's the story. We have an associated event called Maker Faire. Last spring drew 75,000 people to San Mateo.
We've talked to Dale on this broadcast.
You have. Yes, that's right. He told me that. Yeah. Like a county fair with robots. But here's the example of pattern recognition that Dale also, his background was in English, not in, when I first hired him, he was thinking he was going to grow up and be a playwright, right? Here in one pavilion is the Alameda Contra Costa Computer Recycling Society, a bunch of Linux geeks, and they are showing off their biodiesel-powered supercomputer made out of recycled PCs running Linux. And in the next booth, in the next pavilion over, is a woman who started this thing called the Swap-a-Rama-Rama, which is this clothing swap where people bring in clothes. And there's people there with silk screening machines, sewing machines, and they help them remanufacture them on the spot, and then they have a fashion show at the end of the day. And the genius of Dale's pattern recognition was to say these two things have something in common, to say these people are makers. And just like we created a new name, open source, we created a new name, Web 2.0. With Make, we created a new name that gives people an identity across what they do. These are people who realize that they don't have to take the world as it's given. They can actually start to change things, shape things. And it's also a testimony to how technology is really taking us back to the world of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I guess pattern recognition is what I got from classics.
Here now is Marianne in Washington, D.C. Marianne, you're on the air with Tim O'Reilly. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Well, I think that we've all kind of come to terms with the fact that we have to kind of abandon our previously conceived notions of privacy, personal privacy. But now in the age where, basically teenagers are hacking into to Pentagon websites, I'm wondering if governments are kind of rethinking their views of secrecy. We're talking to each other, we're tweeting each other in Moldova and in Iran as well as in Starbucks. So I don't know if you could speak about that in terms of government control over information and then secrecy.
Yeah, there's a really interesting set of issues there, because there's no question that there are certain things that we need to be private, that we need to be secret. one of the problems, of course, is many people go too far and they think everything needs to be secret. And they also think that the way to have things be secret is to put up big walls and moats. You know, we remember this back from World War I when the French put up this thing called the Maginot Line, and it didn't work. And, you know, so there's a security expert named Bruce Schneier who has this really great rant about how the real right way to approach security is to think about how systems fail, assume that they will fail, and try to make them fail gracefully. You know, so you don't sit there building this huge lockdown system where nothing can happen. Instead, you try to make a system that's resilient. You try to make a system that where you detect problems early and quickly and are able to respond. You know, the fact is, you know, the traditional approach to security is a lot like Howard Hughes' approach to health. You know, lock yourself in a room and hope that no germs get to you. And in fact, the way that our human bodies do it is if you're healthy, you're resilient. So resilience is what we have to learn to build into our systems.
Marianne, thank you for your call.
Welcome.
On to John in Herndon, Virginia. John, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Kojo.
Hey, John.
I heard on NPR that Google was coming out with an operating system to compete with Microsoft, and I had just, like, 2 days before decided that I just couldn't stand Microsoft anymore, and I haven't heard another word about it. What's going on?
Yeah, first of all, really important thing for everybody to understand. What you think of as an operating system today is really just a device driver, you know, because what there's only one operating system that matters, and it's the operating system of the cloud. When you think about all the new applications that, you know, you care about, the Facebooks, the, the Googles, the, you know, Google Maps, Amazon, any of these applications, they're not running on your PC. You know, that's just a little local device that lets you access it. And, of course, you think, well, you know, whether you're on Windows or whether you're on the Mac or whether you're on Linux, you know, the web browser is your most important app because it's really your interface to the real operating system, which is this cloud operating system, which I called Web 2.0. And that doesn't mean, of course, that a new operating system isn't important. But you have to understand what Google's interest is not really – it's not really displacing Microsoft. You know, if you look at the battle between those two companies, Microsoft probably, despite what Steve Ballmer says, doesn't think that it's going to beat Google on search, but they feel like they've got to, you know, keep them occupied, you know, and of course Google says, well, we got to keep Microsoft occupied on their turf. You know, and, you know, so there's this new class of netbooks, which are, you know, lightweight computers that are really optimized for accessing cloud applications. And, of course, Google really has a chance to create a new lighter weight opportunity there. And I think that's what the real significance of the Chrome OS is. It's still at least a year away. I'm not sure it really matters. I shouldn't say that. It could matter a lot in certain markets, but you've got to realize that the future platform is the phone. More than anything else, you know, the app. You know, it's going to be the phone plus the cloud, and maybe we'll have. And I actually think, you know, if you really want to get slightly futuristic, look at some of the Android apps that are coming out. This is the Android Google phone, and also for the iPhone 3GS. We're looking at heads-up displays. The phone knows where it is. It knows what direction it's pointing. It's got a camera, which is a sensor. So, you know, for example, this is an application. You can point it at a monument, and it'll pop up the little Wikipedia entry saying you're looking at, you know, the Eiffel Tower, or you're looking at the White House. It knows where you are, so it can recognize that picture. Think about that. Cloud database, image recognition happening in the cloud. Now, where does that go? It goes towards, we're all wearing glasses with a heads-up display. You know, I look at Kojo, he's in my address book, and it's got his picture and says, oh yeah, that's Kojo Namdi, in case you forgot his name. You know, I mean, that, don't laugh. I mean, we've had visions like that for a long time, but it's getting closer. You know, and this is a crazy hacker, Tad Starner, who's now a professor, I think, at Georgia Tech. You know, and you look at the evolution back in the 80s when he was at MIT, he was walking around with these big computer backpack and goggles. You know, he now, you look at him now, he looks like an ordinary guy, but he's wearing augmented reality goggles. augmented reality is very much in our future.
John, thank you for your call. Many of the true innovators in this field are motivated by goals other than profit, but it's also important to get for-profit companies, we talked about Microsoft and Google, involved. How important is the profit motive when we're talking about government 2.0?
You know, I think the profit motive is huge. I mean, and in fact, you know, what government wants to do is enable a vibrant marketplace. Anish Chopra has this wonderful, the new federal CTO, has this wonderful riff about why he always loved, when he was Secretary of Technology for Virginia, that Virginia was called a commonwealth rather than a state, because it was this idea that it is the wealth that we create together. And I think that... you know, part of that wealth creation is, in fact, the commerce that we do together. The lesson, though, that I think we've taken from, I think, particularly the excesses of the last, you know, couple of decades in, you know, people who are making more and more money at the expense of other people, not necessarily ethically, is we've forgotten that this should be something that's beneficial for both parties. And I always use a motto that we use in my business, and I think should be in a motto that's followed by every business, is create more value than you capture.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, like, if you look at, for example, the history of technology, in Microsoft's early years, really probably up through the mid-90s, they were clearly creating more value than they captured. Even though they were making money hand over fist, they created this PC revolution that we all enjoyed. And then at some point, they reached the peak of that, and they started capturing more value than they created. They started putting their competitors out of business. They started saying, well, in order to keep growing, we've got to eat our children, you know, so on. And, you know, so innovation went somewhere else. Now, we'll probably follow that same path with Google or whatever. I think we have to realize that, you know, innovation happens when we create value for the ecosystem as a whole.
We got to take a short break on this Tech Tuesday conversation with techno evangelist Tim O'Reilly, but you can still call us, 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org or send us a tweet at Kojo Show. It's Tech Tuesday. I'm Kojo Nnamdi. Coming up at 1, why the Equal Rights Amendment became the Women's Equality Amendment. We meet the Bethesda mom now leading the National Organization for Women. Plus, it's your turn. Talk about rest areas closing in Virginia, Florida manatees showing up in Maryland, or the district's revived medical marijuana law. You set the agenda today at 1 on the Kojo Nnamdi Show on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the Maya Tech Corporation, providing research, training, and information technology for our nation's public health initiatives. Career opportunities at mayatech.com. From University of Maryland, Baltimore County's Department of Information Systems, offering an online master's program in information systems. Fall applications due August 16th. More at onlinems.umbc.edu.
President Obama recently announced a new way to jumpstart the economy and train workers for emerging industries, send $12 billion to community colleges.
We'll fund programs that connect students looking for jobs with businesses that are looking to hire.
How often overlooked community colleges are now at the center of the country's plans for economic recovery. That's next time on Tell Me More.
That's on Tell Me More at 2 here on WAMU 88.5.
Partly cloudy and 79 degrees in Northwest Washington. Now back to the Kojo Nnamdi Show.
It's Tech Tuesday. We're talking with Tim O'Reilly, founder and CEO of O'Reilly Media Incorporated, about government 2.0 on a national level. Tim, President Obama campaigned saying all the right things about openness and about transparency, but he soon found out that the existing rules and institutions governing government data and things like contracting create huge obstacles for the free flow of information. Now, you think we're in the midst of a rare opening where the technology community could step up to the plate and make a major contribution to democracy, but this opening won't last forever, will it?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think we really have to show results from this new approach. And I think that's certainly what Anish Chopra and Vivek Kundra are saying. You know, we've got to show results for our boss in this first year. Because at the end of the first year, we're already in congressional campaigning season. And right now, if there's ever a time when Congress will embrace transparency, it's now. Because, for example, the Republicans are in the minority, and they want transparency. In fact, they've been more active. People like John Culberson introduced a bill, trying to get Congress to be more transparent. Why? Because transparency is always the friend of the minority. The Democrats want it, at least on paper, because Obama wants it. Now's the time for us to strike. That kind of brings up another point that I think is so super important. When I went to see John Culberson, I actually went to see him because some social network analysis done by some guy in London pointed out that he's the central node in the congressional Twitter network. He's the guy who communicates, actually has more back and forth with more other members of Congress than any other. So I went to see him to talk about that. And he showed me this letter from Thomas Jefferson to Joseph Campbell. And it was really about the structure of government. It was this testimonial to kind of the core values that drive the Republican Party. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is such a great description of Gov2.0. And so I'm out there saying, this is coming from President Obama, but this is such a Republican story. It's a story of how government can become more effective as a platform by enabling the marketplace, by enabling the citizens. And so really, we have a possibility, if we can get beyond partisan politics, to get both sides together to say, this actually is a way to get government smaller. I mean, Apple... again, going back to the iPhone, it's like government right now is like your old phone. There's a couple of preferred providers. They figured out what applications they're going to offer. And then Apple opened up this platform. And all of a sudden, there's 50,000 applications in less than a year. And, billions of them downloaded. And the other guys are like, what do we do? And government's kind of like that. They have the preferred providers. Of course, the Obama tech team is saying, no, we're going to become a platform. We're going to enable this kind of innovation. And what it's going to enable is the marketplace to deliver services, potentially competing with government services. And then hopefully the government will be able to say, hey, we can spend our money more wisely.
There are so many aspects of this I want to get to. But first, I got to get to the phones again. And Angela in Hyattsville, Maryland. Angela, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon to the both of you.
Good afternoon.
Hi there.
Quick question. You had mentioned something about augmented reality.
Yeah.
And I wanted you to expand on that, because when you said that, I instantly thought of two things. One, I'm a photographer, and I work with Photoshop, and sometimes people want to look more attractive, so you whiten their teeth or you remove a pimple or a wrinkle.
Yeah.
And so I sort of thought of that. And then the other thing I thought of was Forrest Gump, where and throughout the movie there were various scenes where you saw Forrest superimposed in scenes where he's speaking to President Kennedy, and obviously you can tell he's superimposed, but I'm thinking after a while, with technology advancing so well, that after a while that will seem seamless.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking with the government getting more and more advanced with technology and such, if they were to air something like a webisode, I'm thinking, when you said augmented reality.
You're thinking of the power of... You're thinking of the power of deception, huh, Angela?
I am. So
okay.
Well, that's one part of it. I mean, actually, I was just talking with somebody from the DOD, for example, about one of the risks of all this future is because so many of the applications of the future are data-based, the security risks are actually people putting in bad data. And that's exactly what you're talking about. And, of course, that brings up why, of course, these systems need to be robust and resilient and responsive, because then you detect the bad data. There's so many ways you can do this technically. People are spamming Google all the time, and sometimes they get stuff through, but Google has systems to almost autonomically respond. But I want to come back to exactly what we mean by augmented reality. It's not, certainly there's a sign of some similar trends in the way that we doctor Photoshop figures already. You have this on television. You let's say you're watching a sports game. It used to be there were physical banners there on the, in the arena, and now they're digital overlays. So for example, if you're in Houston, you know, and Yao Ming is playing. There's all kinds of ads to the Chinese American community. But if you're in, you know, Boston, you know, you might not see those because it's not as big a Chinese community. You know, it's that kind of thing that's it's already there on television. But what I'm talking about specifically is the way that just in walking around with our devices. I mean, think about it. If you carry a smartphone like an iPhone, your reality is already augmented, right? You might not know where you are, but your phone does. And your phone can report it to your application. As I've been going to meetings around D.C., I use my iPhone to get directions, and I like to walk to get some exercise. So I'm walking, and you know, I look, and there is my little dot on the map showing me how far I am along the path.
That's augmented.
That's augmented reality, right? In real time, my phone is keeping up with where I am. Now imagine some of the new technologies that are coming. We have speech recognition, which is getting better and better on the phone. We have image recognition. Now, you guys may not have played with this, but there's like in iPhoto 09, there's image recognition. So it'll look at the pictures and ask you to identify them. I say, oh, that's my wife, Christina. And then it finds all the other pictures that it thinks are her. By the time you've gone through 15 or 20, it's pretty well trained.
Mm.
Okay, now I think Picasa has the same thing, you know, Google's image thing. Now imagine this. Image recognition, looking at billions of photos, may be pretty hard. But now imagine image recognition mixed with a social network. Your social network says, okay, I've got a million photos, but I only have to look and see if it's one of these people you know, mm-hmm. right? And it probably can fill in a lot of the gaps right there. And it can, so the training set becomes smaller and smaller. And I think that this is, again, goes back to this idea of Web 2.0 as an operating system. It's about cooperating data systems. A great example I use all the time is the Google mobile search. When you search for pizza, it's speech recognition. The speech recognition is coordinated with Google's search database, so it knows that you're more likely to be searching for pizza than, say, Pisa, the town in Italy, even though they sound kind of similar. So that actually makes their speech recognition better. And then it knows where you are, and so it gives you the location of three local pizza places. It doesn't give you, the Wikipedia entry for pizza. It gives you the three nearest pizza places. That's augmented reality in its embryo. Now, just keep following along that and, think about your phone has a location sensor. It knows where it is. It has an ear. And there's a number of startups that are already doing this. Something called IMMI, which competes with Nielsen, where rather than having the people, fill out a form, they have a cell phone that just wakes up periodically and listens and says, did I hear a commercial? So it's happening already. There's eyes, the camera, these things have cameras. So it's all coming together.
Augmented reality, Angela, thank you for your call. This email we got from Constance in Silver Spring. Government 2.0 sounds wonderful. A few people find a problem, start a wiki, and get together a group to do something. Example, fixed a washed out road in a national park. Government 2.0 participants can go everywhere, like bees flitting from flower to flower in a search for the most productive activities, without the constraint of professional standards and county budgets, and that's exactly the problem. What happens when these government 2.0 amateurs lose interest in a project? What happens to the road in the park next year when the flood damage has been forgotten and popular interest has moved on to, for example, building a playground for handicapped kids, which will be abandoned in turn when people get bored with it? Will this government by amateurs work without some kind of professional or government 1.0 backup?
Oh, I think... no one is proposing that, it all, we have the withering away of the state. It's really about how do you get leverage? In fact, a really good platform provider often has very, very strict rules. When you look at the internet, there are these fixed protocols that say, if you want to play, this is how you do it.
Is there a class component to these conversations? Don't these conversations presuppose that your average citizen has access to broadband or wireless?
Yes and no. I mean, in one sense, there's certainly an element of that, but all you have to do is look at Africa. My gosh, there are people who are spending, 20% of their annual income to have a mobile phone because it empowers them. And I think, Africa is just there's some amazing stuff if you follow. Like, there's a fabulous blog called AfriGadget. And we had the guy who runs it gives this amazing talk where he shows you these amazing contraptions. And, it's like, what does this do? And things that are made so creatively, the ingenuity. The fact is, in countries like that, you know, the communications tools are enabling coordination. You know, the farmer can figure out where the best prices are to take his stuff to market. People are building micro businesses. There's even a business that's been launched that uses Amazon's Mechanical Turk and lets African workers do the jobs. You know, the few pennies that Amazon pays aren't maybe worth it to Americans, but they sure as heck are worth it to people where, you know, the average dollar, you know, the average, you know, daily wage is less than a dollar, you know?
Back to the telephones, and we're running out of time very rapidly. Mike, you're on the air. Mike in Timonium, Maryland, go ahead, please.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I am a systems administrator, and Mr. O'Reilly has been talking about what we refer – I'm sorry, Tim. Has been talking about what we refer to as the client side. What does he see as the future of the server side? And as an aside, shouldn't government from the top level to the bottom level – be subject to systems analysis, and I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you.
All right.
Thanks for your call, Mike.
So first of all, I don't think I've been talking about the client side. When I say that Google's doing speech recognition, where do you think that speech recognition is happening? It's happening on the server side. Everything about Web 2.0, all the power is on the server side. It's in these huge databases that are accumulating through user contribution. Every time somebody talks to the Google voice search, it gets smarter because it's heard more voices. You know, every time somebody records their location, things get smarter. That's the nature of this internet as platform. It's all back end. Now, should it be subject to systems analysis? Yes and no. It depends on the kind of system and the kinds of systems analysis. The fact is, there are best practices of rapid development. You know, when you look at a company like Amazon, amazing pioneering company, they're building their systems under a whole new set of rules. You know, this is not the Tom DeMarco era of system management and design. You know, this is we have a conference called Velocity, which is all about best practices of building these giant, they're almost like living things, these systems. And I think that the rules of designing them is much more evolutionary than it is somebody sitting in a room and doing lots and lots of flowcharts and figuring it out. That's actually one of the big changes. It's really experimenting live with your audience. That's what we learned from Web 2.0 companies.
We have time for just one more email from Kenneth. He said, I did not know about Tim O'Reilly before today, but after looking at his websites today, I have bookmarked them and I plan to check them as often as possible. When I saw the name O'Reilly Radar, I had a long laugh out loud. I wonder how many MASH fans have seen it and how many people are too young to get the name.
I love it when people twig to that. It just seemed like a sweet name. It's the name of my blog. And it really is, Radar O'Reilly, of course, was the character who anticipated your needs. And a lot of the technologies I talk about are pre-commercial. And so people often, they don't get it when I first start talking about something. I started talking about the internet as platform in 1997. I started publishing about open source in 1988. And people, I would go out there and I would evangelize and I tried to get research companies to follow this stuff, and they don't. So I just figure, hey, I'll just try to work on advancing this stuff to the future, and when people need it, I'll just happen to have
Tim Radar O'Reilly, founder and CEO of O'Reilly Media Incorporated. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. This has been fun.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up tomorrow on the Kojo Nandi Show, Metro General Manager John Cato on the political and practical fallout of last month's crash. We talk overcrowding, safety, and maintenance, and take your questions. Then, why humans have not yet traveled to Mars, the tech challenges, the cool opportunities, and the funding realities of going to the red planet. The Kojo Nandi Show, noon till 2 tomorrow on WAMU 88.5.
Today's program.